Broadcasting from Youngstown, Ohio, this is the MV Red Podcast, the show where we talk about news and politics impacting the Mahoning Valley, the state of Ohio, and the USA. If you want to subscribe to our podcast, find us on your favorite podcast streaming app or visit our website, www.mvred.com. If you want to share your opinion with us, please email info@mvred.com, as we would love to hear from you. Now, let's get things started. Here are your hosts, Michael Metzinger and Dane Davis.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first edition of the MV Red Podcast. My name is Michael Metzinger, and joining me is my co-host, Dane Davis. We're so happy and thankful that you're tuning into our first episode here today. So on today's episode, we're going to focus more on national politics. We're going to talk about the Democratic power rankings, and that's going to be Dane and I giving you our top five candidates as the race currently stands, kind of give you some background as to why we think certain candidates are ahead of others. And in future episodes, we'll continue to adjust that, but we'll at least do it. We're second half of July, kind of give you an idea of where we think the Democrats currently stand in terms of the presidential race. Then we're going to talk about Donald Trump defending Nancy Pelosi about a week ago. Nancy Pelosi has a tough job on her hands. She has a party. It's a Big Ten party, and she has a very vocal far left wing of the Democratic Party. So she has to kind of do a balancing act there. So I found it kind of interesting that Donald Trump came to her defense about a week ago. And then lastly, we're going to talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She was questioning the former acting head of ICE. His name's Tom Homan, and he was firing back at her, and at one point she was left speechless. So it's kind of interesting to listen to that. So we'll have an audio clip of that and also discuss. So before we jump into all of that, I figured it would be a good idea to give some introductions, being it's our first episode. So Dane, why don't you take it away? Tell us a little bit about yourself. Why you have interest in politics and what you do for a living and anything else you want to let us know.
I just want to start out, Michael, to say how honored I am to be on the Mahoning Valley Red inaugural podcast. I remember 2004 you started Mahoning Valley Red. Was it 2004 or 2005?
Seven. It was my senior year of high school because I specifically remember it was during the kind of like where we're currently at. Like it was the summer or fall of my senior year, which would have been 07. And then like the debates and all that. It may have been, you might be right. It may have been sooner, but I think when we started to really jump into it would have been the fall of 07.
Those folks at home listening, the Mahoning Valley Red was a groundbreaking blog at the time. This is back in the early aughts when blogs were still hip, and the Bush administration wars between the Bush fans and the anti-Bush fans, those wars were raging. And then this young kid, this Michael Metzinger, who to my knowledge was just Tommy Metzinger's younger brother. A blog is the best way to describe it. I think it was a social movement. And Mahoning Valley Red, it painted the Mahoning Valley Red. It took about 12 years to get there, but it worked. And unfortunately,
well, I'm flattered for the nice remarks.
You took down the blog, but it's had a renaissance. It's come back. It's like the Roman Empire, right? We've been threatening to do this podcast for a while, and I said, "Look, I'm a man with far too much time on my hands." It's actually not true, but I wanted to be on this podcast because I'm a total nerd when it comes to this stuff, and I thought, if you ever do it, Michael, let me know. And you're actually doing it. Here we are. So I just want to say how honored again I am to be on the inaugural episode.
Well, we're very grateful to have you.
So just a bit about myself. If you don't know me, I went to high school with Tommy Metzinger. Technically, Shanley, my wife, is his cousin. I think she's like his eighth cousin twice. Yeah.
Something Shanley, like that.
Your cousin as well. I've always liked politics. I'm into politics. I follow politics. I used to live in New York City. I just moved back to Ohio in the great village of Sugarland Falls. And yeah, I'm just excited to be here.
Excellent. And for you, for those of you tuning in, if you listen to the Ron Verb program on 570 WKBN in Youngstown, the host, Ron Verb, absolutely loves Dane. I think you're a frequent caller, and I think maybe you also communicate with him on the side. Is that right?
That's the full extent of my relationship. But I have called into the program, and Ron is a fan. And I try to play straight when I'm on the Ron Verb show. Listen, I have to just say, talk radio performs a very important function. Don't get it. It's a local forum. It's a forum for people who normally don't have a say in things to have a say. So if you ever want to get the pulse of America, listen to talk radio. Listen to the local programs like Ron Verb, which is only in the 570 WKBN area, so Northeast Ohio. And you're going to hear viewpoints that you might not hear expressed in the national media. So for my sake, I want to be on top of trends and I want to know what's going on. So I always, when I have the time, I always try to listen in to hear what people are thinking. So that's why I started calling it.
Well, you also bring a lot of great insight. And I know anytime you call in, he absolutely loves it. And it's worth noting for those of you who may not know, Ron Verb was pretty far, I don't want to say pretty far to the left. He supported President Obama. He voted for him twice. Never really seemed to be one to support any Republicans in the past. I'd occasionally listen to his program, but there would be times I just didn't agree with him, didn't care to listen. But he's come full circle now, and he is – I mean, he's gone pretty far out there to the right. He's a big Donald Trump supporter, and his show has gone – he's out there – on the right. No, I mean, not in a bad way, but he's definitely preaches fiscal conservatism, and he's definitely come a long way. So it's sort of refreshing to see. And it kind of mimics the evolution, if you would, of the politics in the Mahoney Valley.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You get back to Mahoney Valley Red, right? Like, what's the plot of this blog that Michael Metzinger started? The plot was the Mahoney Valley is blue. It's stronghold. It has been for decades. And Mahoney Valley Red was kind of an oxymoron, right? Like the bluest area of Ohio would be red. But what's happened over the past 10, 15 years is that this once very blue collar, kind of conservative Democrat, or at least moderate Democrat area, has shifted to the right. In the 2016 election, famously, Trumbull County voted for Donald Trump. Mahoney County came very close to voting for Donald Trump. Michael Rooley won in the state Senate as a Republican. Don Manning won as a Republican in the Ohio House. I think Judge Russo is the judge that won as a Republican. So the Mahoney Valley has trended further and further to the right. And going back to what we were just talking about, Ron Verb followed that trend or lead it, maybe a little bit of both.
So a little bit about myself. I'm born and raised in the Mahoning Valley, happily married, and have two young sons, one that just turned two and one that just turned a month old. So I'm really blessed to have them in my life. And I know when I told my wife that I was doing a podcast, she gave me one of those funny looks, but like anything else I do, she's 100% supportive, and she's actually been on my case in recent days. She's like, when are you guys going to record this podcast? I want to listen in. So, yes, I'm very fortunate to have my wife supporting me through this and supporting me through some of my strange hobbies like writing and all the other things I do. Always had an interest in politics, dating back to probably when I was in, second grade. I kind of faintly remember first or second grade when there was like Dole versus Clinton or something like that, and just had a huge interest in it. It really just evolved in Bush versus Gore in 2000. And then when I first went into high school in 2004 is when it was Bush versus Kerry. I remember having a George W. Bush bumper sticker on my hoodie at Ursuline High School, and getting a lot of questionable looks from some who clearly did not approve of the my political choice or support, or who I had my who I was behind, but always had an interest in politics. And then that kind of leads me to my next point, which was just talking briefly about MV Red, which Dan has already talked about. But it was really started, I think, my senior year. A friend of mine, Dave Hartman, and I, we would talk at lunch quite a bit, covering, talk about the Republican debates, Democratic debates. At the time, it was Clinton versus Obama. And then on the Republican side, there was Mitt Romney, Rudy Giuliani, John McCain. Who am I missing? Huckabee, there's quite a few. Huckabee. So we just decided, at the time, we have an interest in politics. Let's start writing about it. And that's kind of how MV Red came along. Now, Dave has strayed to the left, but, we had a great run. And Dave, if you are listening, love to have you on at some point in time to talk about that. As I went into college, it just kind of got too hectic to keep the blog up with internships and other things. So went away, but kind of just as of probably 7 months ago, I decided, it's time to bring it back. It's a good time. I wanted to talk more about not only politics, but some things going on locally, but on a political level with the upcoming presidential election and obviously the primaries taking place. I thought, why not? I'm sick and tired of having to pollute my personal social media accounts with this stuff. So I figured, why not just do it on the old website? Nobody else took the domain, so I bought it back. And here we are today with a podcast.
I just want to add, I would never remember the original Honey Valley Red, and I've never read an article for it, but I am a boy. And, dreams can come true, right? I'm like the kid that watched the Star Wars, and now he's in the new Star Wars. I read Mahoning Valley Red back when it was a blog, 07, and now I'm on the podcast. So, reach for the stars, folks. You too could start a podcast.
That's right. So let's move on, and let's start talking about these Democratic power rankings. So, Dane, there's 24, 25, I don't know how many Democrats running for president now, including my congressman. I'm not sure if he's your congressman up there, Tim Ryan. Is he your congressman too? I know he stretches up that
my
way.
My congressman is David Joyce.
Okay, so you have a different congressman. But anyways, there's a lot of Democrats running, and really in my eyes, it's kind of down to five or six legitimate candidates. So why don't you give us your top five candidates as we stand here second half of July, I think about a week out before the next Democratic
debate. Yeah, I think that's a great question. So first of all, I just want to say when I look at and rank the Democrats, it's not based on my partisan views. I try to look at it as objectively as possible, right? Like who's the weakest on the national electorate and with the momentum and a bunch of other factors. So don't think this is just me saying – oh yeah, these guys are stupid. They're gonna lose or whatever. That's not how I look at it. I try to play it fair and straight when it comes to ranking them. The other point, real quick, before I get into the ranking, is I think I'm the only one who has been to one of their launches. That's right. I was at the Tim Ryan launch in downtown Youngstown. I went to that. I got a free T-shirt. It's a very very soft T-shirt, and I wear it a bit soft. But I was there. Michael, were you supporting your local congressman?
I can't say I was in attendance.
No, you missed out. I love going to rallies. I'll go to rallies of all sorts. I went to the Hillary Clinton rally back in 08. Went to Tim Ryan in the launch. So I just love rallies for the sake of rallies. But okay, let's go to your main question, right? The ranking of the top Democrat candidates. I think that there's a top echelon clearly developing. If you just go by the poll, somebody like Biden is at the top, followed by an Elizabeth Warren, and then Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, depending upon the poll, and then Pete Buttigieg. I always have trouble saying his name. Is that how you say his name?
I just call him Mayor Pete because I don't even attempt the last name.
Mayor Pete's like tier five. Julian Castro, tier five. Mayor Pete's fifth place, Julian Castro around there, and Amy Klobuchar. But what Cory Booker is also in that second tier as well. But what I find interesting, Michael, is it's clear that Biden is really dominating, right? Like he's in the lead. He has a lot of the institutional support. But he's kind of doing a repeat of the Hillary Clinton strategy where you just kind of hide the candidate in a closet and then just hope that the polls and the establishment support can carry that candidate to victory. Because the thing about Biden is you don't really see him campaigning a lot. He's not doing a ton of campaign events. It's been very rare that Biden goes out there and campaign. And I view him as a paper tiger. I think technically he's in the lead, but I think that because of his advanced age and his tendency for gaffes and his uninspiring record, I think he's going to rapidly diminish. So I think Biden is at the top now, but I don't think he'll be at the top in the end. And instead, I think somebody like Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris or Kamala Harris, they changed her pronunciation. Like,
I noticed that Kamala, as well.
Kamala, so that's kind of weird. But I think Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris are both very, very strong. And I see two tickets emerging, and then I'll turn it back to you. Ticket one is Elizabeth Warren with Cory Booker. Okay. Elizabeth Warren plays very well to college-educated white liberals. She does not play well to inner-city and urban neighborhoods. So she picks Cory Booker as her counterbalance to kind of offset that weakness. The ticket would be like Bernie Sandersism, right? Socialism without calling it socialism. It'd be progressivism. I think it would do very well, actually. And I think people tend to underestimate Elizabeth Warren. She's a very intelligent woman. I think she would play well. I just think her big problem would be driving up minority turnout in the inner cities. The other ticket I see developing is Kamala Harris and Mayor Pete. And Mayor Pete clearly is not going to be able to make it to the top tier. But a Kamala Harris, you know, she is a minority woman. She comes from a West Coast state. She clearly needs to secure the Midwestern base. So I think that's why she picks a Mayor Pete as her vice president. He has an executive experience, even though it's only as a mayor. And he's kind of non-threatening, right? Maybe would play well to the Midwest. So I think those are the two sets of candidates that I see emerging. But interested to get your take on it.
Just so people know, listening, we did not talk about this beforehand, and it's ironic because we are kind of on the same page here. I'll just give you quickly my top five, how I currently see it, and then I'll kind of explain why. So I think Kamala Harris, or however you pronounce her first name, I have her as my number one, and I'll explain in a minute. And right behind her, I have Elizabeth Warren. I think those are going to be two very tough candidates to unseat. And once the Democrats go to the polls, I think they're going to definitely emerge as two heavyweights, and they're going to be, in my eyes, the two to knock off. I agree with you 100% on Joe Biden. I just think, like you said, he is prone to gaffes. He is getting up there in age. And then between him and Bernie Sanders, the thing demographically speaking here, they're both older, and they're both older white men who, you know, in this day and age, the Democratic Party is very diverse, and they're definitely pushing, different minority groups in their party. And I just struggle in this day and age in 2019 to see them nominating, an older white man. It seems like that might be a demographic they go after. And that's a demographic they like to hit the Republicans on. That it's just a party of old white men. So I like Joe Biden. I think he's a very likable person. I think he could play well in the Midwest. But in the end, with the Democratic Party as it currently stands, I do not see him making it. I mean, he'll be in it for a while, but I don't see him emerging as their nominee. And then right behind him, I have Bernie Sanders, and then I have Mayor Pete, since I can't pronounce his last name. But, I just don't see Bernie Sanders. He's up there in age as well, and he's got his core devout followers, but I don't think maybe the more mainstream Democrats view him as electable. His ideas are pretty far out there, and when it comes down to figuring out how you're going to pay for them. It's a tough sell for people, especially when you're going to be forced to raise taxes across the board for every income group. And then lastly, like I said, I had Mayor Pete. I think it's remarkable what he's done thus far. I never heard of him prior to a few months ago, and he's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, home to Notre Dame. Go Irish. I'm a big Notre Dame fan. But it's pretty remarkable for a mayor from, you know, a mid-sized city in Indiana to make it as far as he has. So I definitely think in the long run he could be a force in the party. But I like Harris and I like Warren. I think Harris is very tough. You could tell back during the Kavanaugh hearings. She's a former attorney general from California, and I view her as somebody who would pose quite a few challenges to Donald Trump. I think she would definitely play well with minority groups, and especially minority groups in such a state like Michigan that really hurt Hillary Clinton in the last election. And then Elizabeth Warren, listen, she's a darling of the left. They love her. She's tough. She's very smart. What I do view her as, though, I think she's going to struggle in a general election for that DNA test she took. I think it played right in the hands of Donald Trump. And whether you like his nicknames or not, or view him as childish or not, the nickname Pocahontas, I do think, sticks with some people. And I do think that DNA test, in the long run, could hurt her. But I do think she's going to be very tough in the Democratic side. And if she does make it to that debate stage against Donald Trump, she's going to come out fighting, and she's going to be a force, and Donald Trump needs to be ready. But that's kind of how I view things as well. But I do have Harris and Warren as my top two right now.
I have a couple comments on all the candidates. I think Biden, okay, we're totally agreed on Biden. I think everybody in their mind is viewing Biden as the Joe Biden of 2012. Right, the last time he was really on the public stage, or even 2016. But if you watch him recently, there's been a very serious aging for Joe Biden. And I think that the Joe Biden of 2019 is very different than even, you know, 3 years ago or 4 years ago.
Yep, I agree 100%. I've noticed it as well.
It's very noticeable. Bernie Sanders, I think, is sharper than Joe Biden, but his age is a big factor. I think that the moment is not there. And I just don't think that there's the enthusiasm. You got to remember, with Bernie Sanders, it was a binary choice between Hillary and Bernie. And that kind of drove a lot of his support. Now that there's a lot of different options and flavors, that's kind of dampening the Biden or the Bernie Sanders support. But, you know, I think that Republicans tend to underestimate the Sanders threat. And then maybe this is a topic for another episode. But could Sanders win? Absolutely. He'd have to go through the industrial Midwest, but somebody like him could totally win. Kamala Harris is interesting because, you know, while she's clearly a minority, she has not had the typical minority background. Her father was a Jamaican economics professor. Her mother, an Indian professor or lawyer or doctor, I don't remember, but she came from an upper middle class family, was born and raised in Berkeley. I mean, for Obama, that wasn't a big issue, but there is this connectivity issue, right? And currently the person with the most amount of black support is Joe Biden, not Kamala Harris. She's had trouble catching on, until very recently. And then, two more points. One is on Elizabeth Warren. I think Elizabeth Warren has a WASPy air to her that turns off a lot of ethnic white, Catholic Democratic voters. So, you know, like the Polish Catholics, the Irish Catholics, the Italians, these guys used to vote Democrats in large numbers. Think of the Parma, Ohio, right? Barbara Mikuski, I forget her last name, in Maryland. She's their former senator. Elizabeth Warren, I think, reminds them on an instinctual level of like that country club, the white shoot country club that was WASPy and wouldn't let them in. So Warren is alienating to a lot of people, a lot of Democrats, surprisingly. I mean, I like her. I think she's intelligent. She would have problems.
Yeah,
there.
No, I don't disagree with you on that.
Mayor Pete reminds me of like a corp gay pride logo, right? Like there's something insincere about Mayor Pete and something artificial. You know how like during Pride Month, all the corporate logos change their colors to the rainbow flag, right? Like the Goldman Sachs rainbow flag logo.
And there's something very artificial about it. And so too with Mayor Pete. I think he has a very neoliberal core, right? He's very corporate with this veneer of progressivism on top of that. And I just think that the left wing and the Democrats would hate Mayor Pete if he goes any further once they really start to explore who he is.
Good points. And I'll say this, like you were touching on Elizabeth Warren. I don't know. There's something about her. Like most of these people I could find, listen, I wouldn't agree with them as president, but you know, I think they'd be strong leaders. And I'm not saying Elizabeth Warren wouldn't be strong, but I view her as having I think she would struggle in some parts of the country. I view – look at the Democrats of the past. They're more union voters, manufacturing-type workers. I just view her as somebody who just would not connect with them very well, especially like in Northeast Ohio, more, you know, the Rust Belt, those types of voters. I just don't see that connection with her. She, to me, reminds me of somebody in – I don't know her entire history, but she reminds me of like a professor from college, extremely educated, very academic, very bright and intelligent. But I just I see a disconnect between her and the voters that the Democrats need to win over in 2020 to beat Donald Trump. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Agreed. Look, I think that it's like John Kerry, right? John Kerry, he had trouble connecting with the blue-collar areas like in Youngstown or in Ohio and in Wisconsin and Michigan. Now, he ultimately won, I think, Michigan and Wisconsin. But John Kerry had trouble connecting with working-class voters. And I think Elizabeth Warren, even though her message might be more tailor-made for him, I think that there is a problem of connection. And again, this is not something that I'm saying I want it to be or I think this is a good thing or whatever. I'm just saying I've noticed that a lot of Democrats who would like a Joe Biden turn off by Elizabeth Warren. It has nothing to do with policy. It has everything to do with personality in that, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, anything else you want to add on the Democrats? I mean, do you want to touch anything on any of the outsiders? I'll say this, in the first debate, I thought there were some good moments. Yeah, I like the senator from Minnesota. Is it Klobuchar? I really like Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, which I noticed some of the right-wing Twitter people I follow seem to find her quite tolerable. And I thought even Congressman Ryan here from my own backyard made some good points, but I think unfortunately for him, it ended on a sour note when Gabbard hit him pretty hard on him, I think, stumbling over what Al-Qaeda versus the Taliban and September 11th. Any other thoughts on any other candidates?
Some quick thoughts on the Tier 3. I love Marianne Williamson.
Oh, I do too, and I look forward to the next debate with her.
I love her. I want her one of her T-shirts. She reminds me of like the 1960s, 1970s New Age Boomer movement was made flesh incarnate. You get Marianne Williamson. So I like her. I like Tulsi Gabbard. I think she destroyed Tim Ryan. I think Tim Ryan has looked like a fool. I do not understand why he's running for president. I think he was trying to get vice president. But I think
I agree with that.
I think like after that moment, nobody's going to take him seriously because, and this is going to sound really rude. Sorry, Tim Ryan, if you're listening, you probably are. He just seemed very dim. He did not seem very intelligent. I mean, some of the points he was making were good, and I agree with you. I hear it, but he just seemed very dim and not that bright. And he just beclowned himself. So he'll be dropping out soon.
Yeah. He just barely made the previous or the next debate, which is I think in the next week. And it's interesting. You talk about Marianne Williamson. She was in the top 14. She had already qualified for the debate as of about a week and a half ago. And it was just, I think a couple days ago that Tim Ryan was officially named as one of the final, the 20 candidates who would be making the debates. But I agree with you. I was kind of surprised when he did announce for president. I thought he had an opening more so on the state level. I thought he should have probably run for Senate against Rob Portman or even governor against Mike DeWine. I think he needs to do – where he's lacking is there's too many Democrats that have much better name recognition because they're senators or former governors or the vice president of the United States. I think him jumping from congressman in Youngstown and Akron, Ohio to this is just too big of a leap. And I thought he could have done himself a service, but I think a bigger service to the Ohio Democratic Party, which is to me, it's in shambles, and maybe run run for governor, because as far as how they've been performing on a statewide level, they have been doing horrific. And I thought somebody like him might be their savior just to keep them relevant and prevent the state from moving further to the right.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, Tim Ryan had charisma, lost it when he was really young. He had that young, charismatic, Catholic Kennedy type thing going for him. And then he kind of just spent all that capital doing nothing. So at one point he had it. And I think that if he were to run on a state level, it would be more logical choice. But I think both you and I know, and most of the people of Ohio know, is that Democrats from Northeast Ohio will never get elected on the state level because they have a horrible reputation, rightly deserved. I mean, the Mahoning Valley is a mess. And the last statewide Mahoning Valley politician that made it on a statewide level was Mark Dan.
Yeah, that didn't end very well for him.
Right? So Northeast Ohio has a horrible reputation statewide. That's why whenever the Democrats run somebody in Ohio, they're always from somewhere else but Youngstown. So I don't think he would win on a state level. I think it would be his best shot. I think it would be a compelling candidacy. I still think he would lose, though. But, you know, it would have been a more logical choice than running for president. But, hey, look, I got a nice T-shirt. It's very soft.
That's always a plus. Yeah. I think that would be a good shirt for yard work or anything like that, working outside.
Yeah, totally is.
Anything else on the candidates before we move on?
I think this will be next. We'll revisit this after the next debate.
Yeah, it should be really interesting, and I plan, and don't let me forget, to have some Marion Williamson sound clips. I think she comes at things from a completely different point of view, and for somebody like me who is a CPA and is just, thinking things from like a business perspective, I can't quite, equate with her perspective on things, but it was rather interesting in the previous debate to hear some of the things she talked about and how she would call the Prime Minister of New Zealand as the first thing if you were elected president and say our kids are going to have it better here than there, or whatever she said. So I vow that hopefully she has some good sound clips and I'll play them in the next debate. But let's move on and let's talk about President Trump. A week and a half ago, he came to the defense of Nancy Pelosi, and I have the clip here. Let's play it, and then we'll talk.
Well, I think Cortez, who kept Amazon out of New York, and they don't like her for that, thousands and thousands of jobs, I think Cortez is being very disrespectful to somebody that's been there a long time. I deal with Nancy Pelosi a lot, and we go back and forth, and it's fine. But I think that a group of people is being very disrespectful to her. And you know what? I don't think that Nancy can let that go on. A group of people that came from, I don't know where they came from. I'm looking at this Omar from Minnesota. And if one half of the things they're saying about her are true, she shouldn't even be in office. But Cortez should treat Nancy Pelosi with respect. She should not be doing what she's doing. And I'll tell you something about Nancy Pelosi that you know better than I do. She is not a racist, okay? She is not a racist. For them to call her a racist is a disgrace.
All right, so there's President Trump about a week ago. Dane, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, well, it's interesting. I mean, the Democratic Party is clearly in the middle of, call it a three-way civil war, right? You have what's the remnants of a moderate conservative faction who have been completely almost pushed out totally, right? But they're still there, especially in the voting base, maybe not in the establishment. But then you have the Democratic establishment, which I think is best represented by Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. These are people who are clearly left-wing, they're left-wing comparative to the median voter, right? Mm-hmm. But they also are very pragmatic and they know how to win elections. And they're almost non-ideological, right? Like, they'll take any left-wing opening they can take, but they also want to win. So they balance these two criteria. And they recognize that a lot of their members, maybe not Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi themselves, but a lot of their members are in swing districts, right? Especially after the most recent election. So they are I don't want to say that they're centrist. I don't think that's quite right, but they're more concerned with the electoral issues. And then you have this new, the squad, right? The four new representatives. But they're really, I think, symbolic of the new socialist movement in the Democratic Party. And I actually think that the future of the Democratic Party is with socialism. I think that this movement is going to grow stronger and stronger. They're from very blue areas, downtown Minneapolis, Queens, New York. I can't remember where the other two are from. I think one's from Boston and the other's from Detroit. So these are areas that are in no danger of flipping red. And they have been waging a war against the Democrats to kind of hold them accountable to their principles. And on some level, I kind of respect them because they are waging an insurgency against an ossified Democratic establishment. And I want to put it this really interesting hot take for you. Ilhan Omar and AOC are the Donald Trumps of the Democratic Party in 2020. And what I mean by that is, you know, the Republican Party had kind of calcified with this stale Bushism, right? Neoconservatism in foreign policy and, like, you know, Paul Ryan on domestic policy, right? Like, the free market will fix it. And by the way, let's go invade and blow up Iran. And Donald Trump challenged that because he said, you know, I don't want to cut entitlement programs, which is a direct counter to Paul Ryan. And he also said, I don't want to invade the rest of the world and rebuild the rest of the world. And that was a huge revolution. Well, I think, you know, somebody like Ilhan Omar, AOC, I think they speak for the Democratic base more than a Nancy Pelosi does, because they are kind of, the Democratic Party has kind of become soft. And, it, you know, under Obama, the neoliberal core was the ascendant and dominated it. And they are challenging it from the left. And I think they're winning. I think that they have the hearts, minds, and souls of the Democratic base. And so Trump, I think, was clearly, you know, he was trying to stir the pot a bit. He's been trying to stir the pot to keep the war going. And by, you know, he knows he's hated among the Democrats. By defending Pelosi, he was trying to boost her. You know, he just wants the internecine warfare to continue for as long as possible. But that's my initial thoughts. I'll turn it over to you, Mike.
No, I agree with you. I definitely think he was trying to stir the pot. But I do think he has a unique relationship with Nancy Pelosi. I think once she became the Speaker of the House, I think he's been forced to really recognize that she's tough. And she wasn't just handed her position in the Democratic Party. I mean, she earned it. And although I disagree with her on issues, she's done a lot for the Democratic Party. Now, she definitely has her hands full, because, like you said, this is a force, a squad, and they're definitely – I agree with you 100%. I think the future of the Democratic Party is socialism, and this squad is pushing them that way. And I see different people I follow on Facebook and on Twitter that are definitely Democratic voters who really support a lot of their ideas. And they're upset with the approach Nancy Pelosi's taken. So I definitely think this stirring of the pot in some sense has worked, because it's pitting some Democrats who really want to go out that way against Nancy Pelosi, who I view as more pragmatic. Like, think of this impeachment process. You know, I know there was a vote last week, and I think it was like 330-something to 95, something along those lines. It was tabled to impeach President Trump. I think Nancy Pelosi knows darn well if they try to proceed with impeachment hearings, it's going to cost them in 2020.
Right.
But think of the Democrats. For the last 3 years or 2.5 years, they've wanted this president out, and they've tried everything they could. And I mean, there's been plenty of self-inflicted wounds by Donald Trump, but there was this hope that the Mueller report was going to get him, and really wasn't too much there. I know there's a hearing this week, I think later this week, with Bob Mueller, but I don't think much is going to come of it. I just think there's going to be investigation after investigation. But, you know, I think Nancy Pelosi's pragmatic, and she wants to do what's best for her party in 2020. And she realizes she's got to rein the squad in, because I think she knows that those Obama voters that voted that flipped for Trump aren't going to just magically flip back to these far left socialist ideas. They got to do something to win over those voters that they previously had, especially in the Rust Belt. And I don't think playing to the squad is necessarily the answer.
Yeah, I don't think so. Although I think that, you know, the Republicans should not discount the fact that the squad's ideas, they have been able to completely conquer the Democratic Party, right? Like, there was the idea of a $15 an hour minimum wage a few years ago was like an extreme idea. And now it's just passed the House of Representatives. And now they're calling for a $20 an hour minimum wage. The idea of Medicare for all was, again, another extreme idea, which has become the default policy platform. So, you know, I think that whereas the squad, the individual congresswomen, you know, may not be popular in their polling numbers, their ideas increasingly are, and they're increasingly setting the agenda. So they're winning that battle against Nancy Pelosi. So what Trump wants to do is make it not a battle of policy, but a battle of personalities. Because if he puts, you know, he makes this a battle of personality of Ilhan Omar versus Donald Trump, he might be able to win that. If he makes it a question of, you know, Medicare for all, it becomes much harder of a race, right? The Republicans have always been very weak on health care. And if you're promising to give free health care for everybody, that's a hard race to run against. You know, you might say, well, taxes will go up for that, but, you know, good swath of the country doesn't really care because their health care sucks. So I think it's interesting. The best way to understand the future direction of the United States of America is to realize that conservatism and liberalism are both dying philosophies. And what's replacing them, and it's slow, but it's happening, are a socialism, right, on the left, and a nationalism under the right. Hopefully it will still be a democratic socialism and a restrained nationalism, because we don't want extremist ideologies for either side, right? That would be very, very bad. But I think those are the new dividing fault lines in the American populace.
No, I mean, I agree. I think that's a great point. I never really thought of it that way, but it's definitely – because you hear a lot of this talk that it's going further to the extremes, but I think you say it a lot more eloquently with that democratic socialism and the nationalism on the flip side. So, yeah, it'll be an interesting thing to see moving forward, you know, what Nancy Pelosi does. I know her party and a lot of their voters want Trump out no matter what it takes, and they'd love to get into some impeachment hearings. But I for one, don't see it happening. I think she realizes that it's going to do more harm than good. But that's just my own personal opinion.
I just
don't think it's going to play well to the middle. There's plenty of people in the middle who I think do not like Donald Trump whatsoever, especially his personality.
Right.
They might support some of his policies, but at the end of the day, if they view the Democratic candidate as way too far out there, they're going to be like, it might be another lesser of the two evils thing. It'd be like, as much as I can't stand this guy's personality, you know, the economy's pretty well, my 401k is at record highs, you know, I could deal with it another 4 years if it means a strong economy moving forward and the other things that Donald Trump has done.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think impeachment's a realistic possibility at this point. And I think that Nancy Pelosi knows that. And, you know, Americans don't like sore losers. And I think impeachment looks like sore loserdom. Like, barring some scandal developing that we don't know about, you know, there could always be some court case that emerges or new evidence for that. But as of right now, I think impeachment's highly unlikely. And I don't think it's going to happen. And the more they focus on it, the more they'll be in a weak spot. And by the way, remember, they won the election. The Democrats won the House of Representatives based on health care, but they really have done absolutely nothing on health care. I mean, they've kept Obamacare, mm-hmm. but that's just a defensive action. But they've made no – what is the Democratic health care plan? I really don't know. I mean, we can all agree that the status quo is horrible, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what's their proposal to fix it? I don't know. But that was what they won their race on, and I haven't heard anything about health care.
Yeah, you bring up a good point there, because I definitely think that was it was an interesting strategy for somebody like me who just didn't understand it, but it really played well. in certain parts of the country and a lot of those swing districts, especially with some women voters, and it worked in their favor, and it, you know, paid off, paid big dividends in 2018. But like you said, there really hasn't much been much on the healthcare front. You know, occasionally you'll hear like, oh, you know, get rid of Obamacare, blah, blah, blah. And then what's, you know, what's the Republicans' plan? But there really hasn't been anything on the Democratic side that I could recall coming up for vote on healthcare. Anything else on this before I just want to do one last topic, which is on one of the members of the squad, AOC.
Right, take it away.
All right. So here, it was about a week ago. She was in a hearing, I think, I don't know if it was the House, and I'm not even sure exactly what committee it was, but it was on the conditions at the border, migrant children, and border security. And here is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez questioning the former ICE director, Tom Homan. I thought this was an interesting exchange, so let's listen in.
Zero tolerance was interpreted as the policy that separated children from their
parents. If I get arrested for DUI and I have a young child in a car, I'm going to be separated. When I was a police officer in New York and I arrested a father for domestic violence, I separated that father from his family.
Mr. Homan, with all due respect, legal asylees are not charged with any crime.
When you're in the country illegally, it's violation 8 United States Code 1325.
Seeking asylum is legal.
If you want to seek asylum, you go through the port of entry, do it the legal way. The Attorney General of the United States has made that clear.
Okay.
So that's – there's a full-blown clip. It's about 4 minutes long, but that's kind of the essence of it. I thought it was an interesting exchange because I think this kind of goes into this idea, or at least how I view it, with liberals sometimes maybe view things more with their emotions. And obviously this immigration debate is definitely filled with emotions on each side. But I thought Tom Homan's responses were rather interesting, kind of bringing the laws of the land into play. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, let me go off on this. Let me go ham on this immigration debate. So first of all, I think it's absolutely disgusting that people are describing these detention facilities as concentration camps, right? To describe what the U.S. Border Patrol is doing and compare them to Nazi guards, it first of all shows historical ignorance. It's deeply insulting to the men and women who risk their lives trying to, you know, protect the United States of America, help these people. Yes, help these people and prevent illicit substances and illegal immigrants coming into this country. So that's number one. I think that they have heightened the rhetoric to such a degree that it's absolutely shameful. And, you know, the news media covered up a story, but somebody threw a bomb or something at an ICE facility. The person was shot. This was an anti-Antifa guy, right?
Yep. So, yep, shot and killed, right?
I remember when Sarah Palin had a map with crosshairs, right? And then there was the Gabby Gifford shooting, and they linked Jared Loughner, who was completely certifiably insane, never once saw that image that Sarah Palin shared. They linked it directly to her, and they made her responsible for the Gabby Gifford shooting. You have a guy bombing ICE facilities after a rhetoric of concentration camps. But that's point one. Point number two, in 2014, there was a massive migrant surge, okay, illegal immigration surge. It's interesting the euphemisms that have changed. Illegal alien changed to illegal immigrant, changed to undocumented immigrant, changed to migrant, right? That's
mm-hmm.
But there was a massive surge in illegal immigration with lots of children coming in. The Obama administration was overwhelmed at the time. They were doing similar things that the Trump administration was doing, but never once did you hear them described as Nazis or concentration camps or anything. These facilities were not built in the last 2 years. They've existed for a long time now. So if Donald Trump is running concentration camps, well, then guess what? Barack Obama opened them and built them, okay? It's ridiculous. And then finally, up to 80 to 90% of asylum claims in the United States are rejected, okay? So the idea that these are these people are seeking asylum is just totally false. These are people that want, you know, the economic opportunities of the United States, which are admittedly better than Central America, South America, and now increasingly Africa. And they're, you know, violating U.S. law to get there. I think it's just wrong.
Yeah, no, I agree. And there's been some crazy rhetoric on this particular topic, and at least I think some good has come of it is this fact is I think there are finally people or some consensus that there is a crisis at the border, because when Donald Trump first started pushing this idea of a wall and these other things that he wanted to do at the border, the response was there's not a crisis at the border. Well, now they go to the border and they see what's happening and the overwhelming number of illegal immigrants or migrants or whatever you want to call them in these facilities. And I think now their eyes are opening up. Like, listen, we got a major problem on our hands. And quite frankly, both parties are to blame for this, because this has been going on for quite some time. And to the Democrats that are now going after Donald Trump on this, you had complete control of the U.S. House and Senate from 2008 to 2010. You had an opportunity to do something, and nothing was really done.
Right. Totally right. Totally right. I mean, there's a lot of points to be made, but look, anybody that doubts the efficacy of a wall should look in three areas. Hungary built a wall on their southern border. It cut immigration by 99%. Israel has a wall with the Palestinians. It has resulted in a complete collapse in illegal immigration into Israel. You look up the Israeli wall, right? Turkey has a wall between the Turkish-Syrian border, and it's cut illegal immigration there. So walls work, right, when they're deployed effectively. The idea that, well, a wall was a waste of money is ridiculous. The other thing is, everybody wants to talk about the opioid crisis. Oh, heroin, it's killing our cities. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Do you know where heroin comes from? It's not grown domestically. 97% of heroin comes from Jalisco, Mexico. It's a province in Mexico. It starts with an X, okay? Read Dreamland by Sam Kikone.
U.S. policemen are finding the drug dealers who are largely Mexican and Central American. They're bringing up the heroin. They're dealing it. The U.S. police will arrest them. They'll deport them. And then 6 months later or 6 weeks later, somebody else will come in and fill the gap, right? So if you want to fight the opioid crisis, we need border security. Walls work. Listen, at the end of the day, it's as simple as Democrats want open borders because they want to turn the United States into California. California was at one time the most Republican state in the country. It elected Richard Nixon. It elected Ronald Reagan. Elected Pete Wilson. It was a Republican state, okay? They opened up the borders in California. Now it's as blue as you can get. And it will never vote Republican again in our lifetime. The Democrats have been very clear they want to do that same demographic strategy in Arizona. They want to do it in Texas. And they want to flip that whole southwestern quarter. That's what this is all about. It's about power. And then one final point. Sorry, I get fired up about this issue. The idea that U.S. Border Patrol agents are killing children, as you see on those Facebook memes, it's wrong. It's disgusting. And anybody who shares that is revealing their own ignorance. It takes 2 seconds to do a quick Google search. And what you'll find is that human traffickers are bringing in children that are not their own. These children are malnourished. They're deprived of basic water, and that they get in U.S. Border Patrol custody. They're immediately sent to hospitals, but unfortunately, it's usually too little too late, and they die, okay? It's horrible. It's a tragic situation, but the U.S. Border Patrol is not – we're not killing children. We're not putting children into cages. All these things are very easily disprovable with an iota of research, but people are so committed to the rhetoric. It just is totally disgusting. And it's wrong. So there, I'll get off my soapbox. Sorry about that, Michael.
No. And I really like your point regarding opioids. Of course, here in the Mahoning Valley, it's one of the hardest hit areas of the state of Ohio and in terms of drug overdose deaths. And I, if there's one complaint I would have about the administration, I wish they would have made this more about the drug issue, because I've been thinking all along, this is an issue about our public health in this country. We have a drug problem. What's one way you at least hopefully stop or stem the tide of drugs? Stop the flow of them from coming into this country. And I just wish there'd be more, a bigger push from the Trump administration on this, because these drugs are killing thousands of people across our country, and there's been plenty in our own backyard. I know you're from Trumbull County. I'm from Mahoning County. There are parts of those two counties that have just been inundated with drug overdose deaths, and it's really upsetting to see. So there's more than just letting people in to their country. There's other factors involved which impact not only the coastal or the states along the southwestern border, but impacts all states and all cities and municipalities across the country. So this immigration debate isn't just about, like I said, about those states. It really does impact all of us. And I agree with your point about votes and the future of the party, because you hear it all too much. What's the two big states, and you just mentioned it, that the Democrats want to pick up moving forward? And maybe one's more doable in 2020 than the other. They're Arizona, which I think is pretty doable, and Texas, which is maybe another decade out. Those are two states they really want to go after. And what was interesting in the 2018 election was Florida. Obviously, that's surrounded by water. But there's a huge Hispanic population there, and they really thought that by making it, you know, Trump and the Republicans and how they, you know, their rhetoric about Hispanics and immigration, that they were going to win Florida, the Democrats, it is, and it ended up not working out in their favor. But it's clear to me, and I agree with you 100%, this is about the future of our country and winning elections, and the Democrats definitely view this as an opportunity moving forward to, you know, win those future elections. Because if it's a less, you know, not trying to make it a racial thing, but if it's a white mind plurality instead of a white majority, they're going to have better odds of winning elections.
Yeah, you know, I'll add this point, right? Let's talk about the $15 an hour minimum wage. Democrats claim to stand up for the worker, okay? But who does illegal immigration hurt? It doesn't hurt Mr. Accountant Michael Metzinger, right? It doesn't hurt Mr. Banker Dane Davis. We're not competing against illegal immigrants for our wages, okay? We live in – or we work in restricted labor markets, which gives us very high wages. It gives us good bargaining power. We can make more money, okay? If you're unskilled, if you don't have a college degree, or if you only graduated high school, or maybe you didn't graduate high school, the past three or four decades have been horrible for you. And what's the Democrats' current policy? We're going to bring in millions. We're going to have open borders, de facto open borders, and they are going to be competing directly against these people. You know, they 10, 15 years ago, the big thing was about creationism, right? Well, this is economic creationism, because they're literally ignoring the laws of supply and demand. If you increase the supply of unskilled labor while at the same time decreasing demand thanks to automation, you're going to destroy the wages for that class, and you're going to get social dysfunction. And that's what's been happening in this country. I think we should contain both legal and illegal immigration, not because of any racial thing, but because this is what we need to help the working classes of the country. I'll make one other point. Legal Hispanics who are here and have been here for several generations, they have opinions on illegal immigration equivalent to a lot of Republicans, because they know that these illegal immigrants are pushing against their wages and putting downward pressure. There was a poll that just came out of Mexico the other day, where they talked about like 60% of Mexicans agree with Donald Trump's foreign policy in terms of – or his immigration policy, right? It's not that the Mexicans are suddenly racist or white nationalists. That's absurd. It's they want to protect their country. They want to protect their country's identity, and they want to protect the wages for those at the bottom that face the greatest pressure from illegal immigration. So again, this is an issue that gets me really fired up, because I think it's a matter of basic justice, right? If you have illegal immigration and you do nothing to stop it and you have open borders, it's an injustice to the working class, and it's an injustice to every single man, woman, and child who took the time, effort, and money, and it's a lot of money, to go through the legal immigration system.
All good points. And this is going to be a very interesting debate moving forward to see what happens. I know, you know, bits and pieces, very small amounts of a border wall are being constructed on the southern border. But I think we won't know really until after the 2020 election to see really where this goes. You know, if the Republicans are able to get somewhere, you know, I know Donald Trump's tried different ways to make something happen on the immigration front. And I'm hoping now that some of these Democrats are going down there, they at least see that there is a crisis. You know, Donald Trump was not making that up when he said there's a crisis at our southern border. We need to do something about it. At least they're seeing it now. Obviously, they're not going to like Donald Trump's way of fixing the problem, but at least they're recognizing there is a problem. And it's my hope that in 2020, you get some, you know, whatever crop of representatives going in the Congress that realize, yes, we need to put the partisan part of this aside, and we could probably work something out, whether it's a combination of building a wall, changing our immigration inflow, stopping illegal immigration, and maybe giving, you know, some people, I don't know, like some people, illegals that are in our country right now. I don't know if it's going to be a path to citizen or something along those lines that's going to anger a little bit of every, you know, the opinions of everybody. And nobody's going to be 100% satisfied, but at least maybe a little bit, somebody will get a little bit of what they want. And it might be something like that. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being wishful on that. But I think it's going to be something comprehensive like that that would need to get through Congress for anything to really happen.
Yeah, I'm not very optimistic. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm not very optimistic that there's going to be a resolution.
Yeah, we shall see. So that's all we have on this edition of our first episode here of the MV Red Podcast. So in the next episode, whenever we choose to record that, we'll give you an update on our Democratic power rankings after the next debate, which I believe is next week. And we'll also talk about these Mueller hearings, which the media has been promoting left and right. It's going to be on broadcast television starting with 8 a.m. coverage all day. I mean, to me personally, I thought the coverage of the Kavanaugh hearings with Blasey Forbes and Kavanaugh, to me, was more important than this, because I don't think much is going to come out of it. I read that the Justice Department has already told Mueller that what he says has to be within the confines of his report. So I don't really see much coming out of this. I think it's more political theater. I think it's trying to keep this idea of impeachment alive, or at the very least keep the investigations alive, because the Democrats think it hurts them. But I honestly think to the vast majority of the voting, at least the people who may vote for Donald Trump, his supporters and maybe those in the middle, I don't think there's much that Bob Mueller is going to say tomorrow or on Wednesday that is going to change his mind or change the mind of voters. So we shall see. Anything else from you, Dane?
No, it's just too boring. Nobody cares about Bob Mueller. It's boring. It's boring. That's the biggest sin in politics. You could be wrong, but you got to be interesting. Bob Mueller is just boring. Nobody's going to care.
And we'll leave it with that. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Thank you, Dane, for your analysis as well. And we look forward to having you on in the future. And we look forward to everybody tuning in. Once this is out there, you're going to be able to listen to this podcast on all the major podcasting apps, you know, Apple, Google, there's Spotify. And also, we record this podcast on a platform called Anchor, which is another podcasting app. And if you choose to listen to us on that app, you actually have the ability to send us voice messages. So if you have comments or questions or anything you want us to share in a future episode, you can send us a voice message. We could play it in the next episode and respond to you. And also, you know, in our introduction, we also say, if you want to email us any questions or anything like that, you can email us at info@mvred.com. And I also would encourage you to follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, or just visiting our website, mvred.com. So I want to thank you again, and thank you, Dane, as well. Have a good rest of the day, everybody.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks.